It's called Death, Time and Responsibility. So I'm going to address four of the verses of the Dasadharma Sutta, sort of collectively. And they're these ones. Okay, so the first one is, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. The days and nights are relentlessly passing. This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. Have I experienced any profound truth or wise insights so that when facing death, I need not feel ashamed when questioned by my spiritual companions? This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. So these are all reflections on impermanence and the truth of our own deaths, which we're asking us to consider the nature of our life and how we conduct it. The ninth reflection is, do I take delight in solitude? This should be reflected upon again and again by one who has gone forth. I'm very interested in this. Its obvious meaning is, am I okay on my own? But also for me, it's about also being able to stand on our own ground, being self-reliant and responsible for our actions without needing the validation of others. I think that's really important. We don't need the validation of others. So in some ways, it is about having the strength to stand apart from the crowd, which going forth implies. So I'm going to start by talking about time. Okay. In 1979, Brian Eno was newly in New York. In his personal diary, he wrote about the people he was meeting and what he called their conceptual poverty. As no one seemed to be appeared, and no one appeared to have any kind of investment of any kind in their future except their own, and it was conceived in the narrowest terms, he wrote in his diary. More and more I find I want to live in the big here and the long now. And in 1996, Eno, along with Stuart Brand, now those of you who are old enough to remember the Whole Earth catalogue will remember Stuart Brand. He's a very innovative thinker. Anyway, that's a whole other story, which I'm not going into now. But they set up something called the Long Now Foundation, which is still very active, alive and well in America, and encouraging long-term thinking. Brand wrote, civilization is revving itself into a pathologically short attention span. The trend might be coming from the acceleration of technology, the short horizon perspective of market-driven economics, the next election perspective of democracies, or the distractions of personal multitasking. All are on the increase. Some sort of balancing corrective to the short-sightedness is needed, some mechanism or myth which encourages the long view and taking of long-term responsibility, where long-term is measured at least in centuries. I understand that Native American Indians, when they make decisions about things that affect their community, act on this kind of understanding of time. Now, for them, takes into consideration the contribution of the past seven generations and the effect on the next seven generations. In this sense, they have a sense of investment in and a responsibility for the future, although they will personally not be involved. So I'm going to talk about long-term responsibility. Culturally, we're not so great at this. I have wondered if the threat posed by the Cold War and the nuclear age has had a profound effect that is not often acknowledged. I wonder if it created a kind of fissure in the way that we understand time and has cut us off from being able to envisage a future and plan for it responsibly. I do wonder if it set the seeds for short-terminism and a have-it-now culture. Anyway, this is what we have now, a culture which often appears to have an attention deficit disorder and a technological obsession with faster and faster. Excuse me. Oh, I've got some water. Time is a cultural concept. It's a formation of the mind, an idea or the thought. The Buddha taught in a time and place which was very different from our own, where Vedic understanding of time, the universe, resonated to the breath of Brahma, who breathed in and out every 4,000 million years. History was not written. Planning for the future was not undertaken. The world just was. Spiritual practice was undertaken in the perspective of many lifetimes and within all the time in the world. Time was seen as eternal, change unthought of, the past and the future were to be exactly the same. And I can understand that. I was ordained in the Bhadra Valley in India, and the way of life, apart from the boys playing cricket, the way of life that they'd had for centuries was still existing. People took their animals up the mountain in the mornings and they brought them back in the evenings, and they corralled them in pens made of thorny twigs. No change. You could just look at the landscape and just see it as eternal, endless, timeless. And this lack of sense of time has had implications for Indian society. Western historians complain about the Indian lack of interest in history, as there are few records to locate and ponder on, because nobody has bothered to keep them. Why would you be interested if your worldview maintained that the past, present and the future would be the same as it always has been, and there would be no change? Pingir talks about this everlasting sameness in the Sutta Nipata. Up till now, before I heard Gotama's teaching, people had always told me this. This is how it has always been, and this is how it always will be. Only the constant refrain of tradition, a breeding ground for speculation. In the following verse, he says, "This prince, this beam of light, Gotama, was the only one who dissolved the darkness." And perhaps part of this darkness was the endless repetition and being trapped in a world without the possibility of change. Our modern Western understanding of time has a bit of a different history. In the Dark Ages and before time was measured, dawn and dusk and the changing of the seasons were the measures of time. Monks in the Catholic tradition started measuring time through the burning of candles to enable them to regulate the six offices, the calls to prayer through the day and night. The first mechanical clock was made in the 13th century for the monasteries and only later used to order life in towns. The time in towns and cities, this is really interesting, the time in towns and cities was only synchronised with the coming of the railways. When the timetables needed to work, their times of arrival and departure needed to be accurate. Time has been regulated in our society by the need to structure the day regardless of season and innovations of transport. So time in this respect is culturally determined. In the West, our concept of time has been determined by technology and changes in the patterns of human activity. More often, the view within our society is there is not enough of it. And it is constantly speeding up. Apparently, in the 1970s, in the States, the average commercial was 30 seconds, and now it's 5 seconds. We have a culture of immediacy, goal-orientated, fast and pressurised. Because of this, it is difficult to think and care about the future and the repercussions of our decisions taken today. Another problem with the future is that we die there. This is why it's so hard to take the future personally, because we see the world as infused with our absence. It is understandable that we see death as a limitation and an end to our endeavour and practice. So I'm now going to talk about the sutta sections about death. The Dharma looks right through death, and through it we can learn to have a commitment to those who will come after us. Whatever you think about it personally, the Buddha taught within the perspective of many lives. I have a very strong intuitive response that this is true in some way, and one day I'll find out. I think it is important to entertain the possibility of a continuity of consciousness, which is not based on material matter. It is for me anyway. I have seen quite a few people die, including my father, and it is truly a mysterious event. The reflections in the sutta bring us right up against death and its reality in three ways. The reality is that whatever we love and are attached to will be taken from us. You will have to leave everything behind. You will not get to the end of your to-do list. This is an invitation for us not to hold on to acquisitions, status, situations, experience, and even at the end, our physical body. Shanti Deva says, "This body is but an object on loan. In a moment, life breaks its word." The reality is that every waking morning, our life becomes shorter. One day we will wake to the day we die, Nagarjuna says. Many things threaten life, which is even more ephemeral than a bubble full of air. How amazing the opportunity to exhale after inhaling and to wake from sleep. So this is an invitation to get on with our practice as well as we can every day of our lives. It can be a reminder of the urgency of our practice. I think Bhante said somewhere, something like, plan like you will live forever, meditate as if it's your last day. Or something like that.
I think it was work like
you, work like you live forever. Yeah. Thank you, Parami.
I think that's how I remember it.
The reality is that the practice we do in this lifetime will be halted the day we die, and will it be enough? This is an invitation to review our effort and progress while we are alive, so that we will not be disappointed with ourselves at the end of our lives. Can we die without regret? Although these sections refer to our death, the reflections are about how we live this life, faced with the reality of our own death. It's easy to distance ourselves from our own death. I can think that the hopefully old and compos mentis old lady called Kamasuri, lying on her deathbed, will not be the me that I know today, but of course it will be. Facing our own death is often discouraged in our culture. Death seems to have stopped being part of everyday life, and is hidden discreetly behind the sombre windows of the funeral directors. I've recently had a meeting with Bhante's funeral director, who is a delightful man, and we were talking through what happens immediately after someone's died, and what needs to be done both legally and physically and all kinds of ways. And he was really, really careful in the language he used, and very, very sensitive to people's emotional responses. And there was a bit of me, because he didn't want us to be shocked, and there was a bit of me which wanted to say, don't worry about us. We do the six element practice. We dissolve our bodies. We give them away. We return to the elements. We're not shocked by death. And then I thought, I better not say that in case he's shocked. So our society is encouraging us to be forever young. Let's believe that 60 is the new 40, and pretend it's not going to happen. Or if it is, it's in the far-flung, unimaginable future. And I've had experience of people's inability to confront the possibility of death in my own life. When I was a young woman and my children were very small, my partner in Wales was very ill, and at one stage he was given about 9 months to live. He is still alive and kicking, which is very good news. But we didn't know that was going to happen. So one of the things that we did is we actually had a discussion, and we chose very consciously to be completely upfront with what was going on, including with our small children. And I have walked down the street with Grey and seen people cross the road on the other side because they just couldn't face, you know, just even seeing him, you know. It's a very strong experience. When people die of illness younger than they expect, they're seen as victims. It's some way where we don't expect death to happen. And people have bucket lists which trivialise life. It really upsets me. And meaning and purpose is reduced to bungee jumping and climbing Everest and travelling the world. And, you know, it's not like that. I don't feel that it's like that at all. To face our own death is to live more fully and to turn away from a death-denying culture. To live with more clarity, conviction and urgency. It's also an invitation to live more fully and more responsibly. By clearly facing death, we challenge other people's views and the assumptions of our society. When Grey was very ill, we just perpetually rattled people's skeletons in their cupboards, including my grandmother's. So my grandfather died of lung cancer when he was in his early 60s. And I was never told he was ill. I was told he'd had an accident. He was a builder, and I was told he'd had an accident at work. And the last time I saw him, everybody was pretending that he was going to be okay. And I knew I would not see him again. I was about 12. I knew I would not see him again. And it was so confusing like that. I wasn't allowed to go to the funeral, all sort of things. So when Grey and I decided to be really open about what was going on, we rattled skeletons quite badly. My grandmother came to see me once, and I was in the kitchen at home, and she went, "How's Grey?" You know, and I just went, "You will have to ask him." And it just kind of, you know, you're just like kind of breaking people's moulds of habit. She did. She kind of found her own way of doing it. But I was not going to go into that kind of arena of pretense. Practicing through an awareness of death is about abandoning actions which are done solely for the effect they will have in this lifetime. We are not practicing for the sake of making samsara more comfortable, easier to put up with, but to make real progress with insight in mind. When we die, it is only the deepest part of our being that really matters, and the legacy of our life and actions. We can have the very biggest perspective possible. How do I practice for after my own death? How can I go for refuge for the sake of all beings beyond my own death? This is the change from a paradigm which sees death as a limitation. So I'm going to talk about finite and infinite games. So a few years ago, I came across a reference book which referred to a book which was written about 30 years ago in America by a bloke called James P. Carse. And I sought it out and I read it, and it was one of the most boring books I've ever read in my life. It was just like a whole list. It was just lists and lists. But some of the ideas held within this book were really interesting, and it held a bit of a key to the problem we have with time and the way that we approach our lives. So this book was called Finite and Infinite Games. And the games in the title means any form of human endeavour. It could talk about business, politics, education, family dynamics, religion, football. And it looks at the underlying patterns of behaviour and the assumptions that drive them. So Carse talks about the way we normally live our lives as a finite game. And this will be quite familiar to us. It contains within it views and assumptions we will all recognise. And it's a way of looking at our lives bounded by time. Okay. So finite games are about winning. It's the purpose of getting involved. They are goal orientated. I'll leave this out so you can have a look. You don't have to write fast. Goal orientated. So we are working towards a particular outcome, whether it's getting the job, winning the football match, having a good meditation, avoiding hell. They are all played for the purpose of winning. Players train hard and they keep their learning to themselves. The game is planned in detail and then executed. They are sets of rules and ways of playing. So, I mentioned earlier this week about, I think it was in my small group, about having a career. So once a year I used to have a career interview with my boss, and she used to say to me, when I was a social worker, and she used to say to me, how can we progress your career? And it was a game that I wasn't paying into. So I'd just go, I don't have a career. I don't want a career. I want to turn up, work hard, work well, go home and have you pay me. That's the deal, you know. Career I wasn't interested in. So finite games also, when you change the rules or the situation, the game comes to an end. So when somebody was playing football and they picked up and ran with the ball, it became rugby. The winning excludes the other players in the game, the losers. So in these sort of games, there are winners and losers, and this is why that people keep their learning to themselves. It's so they can win. It seeks to control the future, and the focus is only on how it will end. It employs short-term thinking, today, this year, by the time I die, and death is seen as a defeat. It's the end of play. The only immortality there is through winning and the giving of titles and tributes, and it's dead serious. So you get the picture. This is the perspective of our lives. It's driven, competitive, bounded by rules and expectations. The result is all important, and if we don't get there, we have failed. And we can apply this to our spiritual life if we're not careful. Conceit is a bit like this, judging ourselves as better, not so good as someone else, not respecting our own path and strengths, and thinking that progress only looks a certain way. Carr says that infinite games are very different, and they are not bound by the notion of time poverty, not having enough time, and he characterises them in this way. The purpose of an infinite game becomes the increasingly skilled play of the game rather than the winning. Seeing what is now, being in this moment, rather than living for ends and results in the future. The path is the goal. The game improves through the game evolving. The rules change within situations and players. It's about being, developing, growing, and creativity. Surprise is part of the game. We do not know when we start what will happen. Players help each other to play and share their skills and talents. Anything won is widely shared. When things go well, we all win. The game does not have a beginning nor an ending. The game can go on forever. And death is seen as part of the game. The play is continued after the death of the players. And infinite games are joyful. Reading this list brings a kind of feeling of release and relief in me, actually. It's about patience, generosity, kindness, awareness, and flexibility. It's about cooperation and confidence and taking responsibility for the future. And it's how I see the order functioning at its best. A really good example of the differences between these two approaches was in the so-called race to map the Human Genome Project some years ago. So to catalogue the 3 million letters of the code that make up the human DNA was a huge and really complex task. The sequence of the DNA was seen as an instruction manual for a human being, and it was thought that it would allow genes that cause disease or disability to be identified and then be altered or eliminated. It's actually, they've discovered it's much more complicated than that. What a surprise. It's not that straightforward. So in 1990, there was a publicly funded human genome project, and it was started. And it was a not-for-profit organisation, an international consortium of scientists working cooperatively right across the globe. 6 years into this huge project, a private company, Celera, mounted a private sector effort to sequence the human genetic code. And this turned in, and it wanted to do so because it wanted to patent the code. It wanted to patent the code and stop other people from using it. This turned the scientific inquiry into an idealistic battleground, with the public project's emphasis on the public property of the sequence and the private company attempting to patent the genes it discovered for the benefit of its shareholders. The public consortium made efforts to prevent the genome sequence from becoming privatised, and it did this by every single participating lab uploading their entire findings day by day when they went home. Just before they went home, they made everything they found out public. They argued that what was in the public domain could not be the intellectual property of any individual organisation. The consortium's game could be seen as infinite, cooperative, shared learning, and for the benefit of all. Celera's game was finite, its findings were secret, exclusive, and they were the only people who would win. Actually, at the end, it was nail-biting. They were both really close, really close. And the public effort came just before the private company. And in the end, both parties were invited to the White House. And in June 2000, they had announced they had both completed the mapping of the genome. And also, the information contained in the human genome sequence was declared public property and could be used for anyone. Sadly, this was not the end of the struggle, because it's still going on in terms of Celera and other bodies patenting the techniques to break down genes. And that's a whole other story, and I'm not going there now. But it's a very good example of different ways of working and seeing an outcome. I see my work in the order office as an infinite game. So my regular job description is about administrating a charity, being an event organiser, coordinator for the team, and so on. My esoteric job description is about helping to bring about the conditions necessary for the survival of the Triratnis Buddhist Order for the next 200 years at least. And this is why my desk and my shrine are in the same room, because there's no separation. So I'm going to talk now about spiritual practice as an infinite game. When the Buddha left his home in search of the solution to old age, sickness and death, he could have been seen as setting himself a goal. He underwent training with the foremost teachers in his region, becoming, as described in a meeting with the Jain monk Upaka, as a famously driven ascetic. Perhaps at that time he was playing a finite game. When he left his teachers and sat down under the Bodhi tree, he was determined to realise the truth, however long it took him. The Buddha realised that he could no longer rely on the rules and boundaries of others, and he would have to just take as long as it took, and he made a vow. Here on this seat, my body may shrivel up, my skin, my bones, my flesh dissolve, but my body will not move from this very seat until I have gained enlightenment, so hard to reach in the course of ages. With the realization of enlightenment, the Buddha went beyond our conception of time. His enlightenment was realized in the dimension of eternity. He was simply no longer stained by the concept of time. In the Zen tradition, it is said you are always as close to enlightenment and at the same time as far away from enlightenment as you will ever be. This is an expression of the discontinuity of time that is inherent in enlightenment. To move into a more fluid relation with time is to bring us nearer to reality. We can see our lives as part of an infinite game and one that will not stop with our own death. To do this, we may need to ask ourselves, do we delight in solitude? We do a lot of this work essentially alone. No one can work on our minds for us, and we have to be self-reliant within the context of the order. We will make our own decisions and we will make our own mistakes. Apparently, in correspondence, Bhante wrote, "Speaking personally, I do not want disciples who are meek and obedient and afraid to speak their mind. I want disciples who are bold, self-confident and independent, and who are able of standing against the whole world if necessary." When we join the order, we do something very special, although we may not know it at the time. We are in the process of moving away from the paradigms of our old life and the society we're embedded in. We move away from the dominant views of the westernised world, the worldview we subscribe to often without being aware of it. To place the three jewels at the heart of your life and to reorientate yourself to the spiritual life is difficult and often emotionally challenging. Maybe this is why the ordination process can be long, difficult and at times perplexing. I read somewhere that Zen Buddhists define their tasks as infinite gratitude for the past, infinite service for the present, and infinite responsibility for the future. In this way, seeing our practice and spiritual life from the perspective of infinity, we move towards seeing it all as an enjoyable flow, as something that goes beyond our ordinary understanding of the world, beyond our culturally dominant view of time and our own death. Maybe we can begin to appreciate the play of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. I often think that and see my body in itself as a limitation. Our senses are really limited. So we know that we can't see the full range of light that we know exists. We can't hear as well as bats can. And compared to a beagle, our sense of smell is woeful. Apparently we have enough senses, smell senses in our nose to cover a matchbox, and a beagle has enough to cover two football pitches. Dogs live in a world of smell. That's their predominant sense. So, sometimes I think, what senses don't we have? You know, I really do think there are things that happen out there that we vaguely and strangely know about, but we don't actually have the senses to identify things. So I have a strong sense that our human faculties are real restrictions. So although mostly people see death as a limitation, maybe it isn't. Again, in the Sutta Nipata, the Buddha says to Pingir, "You too will go to the further shore, beyond the draw of death." And Pingir replies, "Yes, I shall go there. I shall go beyond change. I shall go beyond formations. I shall go beyond comparison. There are no more doubts. You may consider this as mind released." May we all make good progress and live in joy.